accession number 18676, reel 11.
We finally left Tripoli by merchant ship and went back to Alexandria, where we were put in a transit camp and starting to get all our equipment made up to full strength again, the famous G1098 and I-1248 stores. We went from there I went on an assault course. Major Rogers had picked me to go on this next venture that we were going on. We didn't know where or what, but we were going to send a light section in with the infantry, and so I knew it was an invasion somewhere. And I was sent with about 10 of our blokes on this assault course down onto Bitter Lakes. I think the place was called Kantara, but I'm not quite sure. Anyway, it was a naval base on the shores of Bitter Lake. Got there Sunday night and was allocated this bed space in this tent. One of these EPIP tents, there was six of us in it. And scrawled on the fly sheet was, "Don't wait, go sick." And by God, I wish we had. Talk about an assault course. Anyway, we started next morning as a mean to carry on. And it was chiefly to do with the infantry landing craft, or as they call them, landing craft infantry assault. And were these flat-bottomed assault boats with a ramp at the front, and they took 30 men. 10 sat on forms along the side and 10 down the middle. And those down the middle, they sat straddle-legged on this sort of bench. And the man at the front of that nearest the bows, he was the lead man. And the idea was that they took you out in this assault boat and brought you back to a beach. And you had to empty one of these landing craft in 30 seconds. That was the time allowed. And the first time we did it, I think it took us about 40 odd. Anyway, they kept practicing and practicing. And what it happened that in the finishes we were getting better and better. As the ramp was going down, the lead man, he was off the ramp before it got level. And the others were following, and he used to fan out. The middle row used to go straight ahead, and the other two rows went either left or right, whichever side of the assault craft they were sitting on. The idea was to minimise casualties. Now, I did this all that day, and the following day we started again, and by this time we'd got it down to about 26 seconds, and we had about another four goes, and we got it down to 20 seconds, and this naval officer who was in charge, "Right, one more time. If you can get it down below 20 seconds, we'll call it a day and we'll finish with this." So I took us out again, turned round and came back in. Well, while you're sat in the boat, in the assault craft, you can't see anything. You don't know where you are, what you're doing. And as we approached the beach, he gave the order, "Ready to go," or something like that. I forget what his exact words were. And the ramp started to go down, and we all shot out of this assault landing craft. I was in the lead, the first one in the middle row. went straight out over the top of the bow as it was coming down, and it took us to a different beach, and it was barbed wire right down into the water, and we all piled up on top of this barbed wire, and all we got was that'll teach you to keep your eyes open. Well, how the hell they expected you to keep your eyes open coming off a landing craft like that, I don't know. Anyway, I got a lump of this barbed wire stuck in my leg. And there was a lot of grumbling and groaning over that. Anyway, cut a long story short, we went out again. And we came back, this time onto a different beach. And as he gave the order approaching beach, I wasn't going to be caught out again. I stood up to see what was happening and got bawled out. Anyway, the ramp went down, we got out, and we got out in 18 seconds. So that satisfied him, and that was finish of that. And then we went on scaling these cliffs of about, 40 foot high. On these so-called climbing ladders. They're like a long pole, steel or aluminium, I don't know what they were, pole, and they had steps, alternate sides, with a hook at the top. And the idea was that you hook that to the top of the cliff and then you climbed up. Well, with a full pack and everything, it was murder trying to do it. Anyway, we had to continue doing it. And there was that, and there was hill climbing, there was rope marches, and we were there 5 days, and during that time there was no naffy, although just over the road was this naval base camp with full facilities, but we weren't allowed in there, and there was naval picket to keep us out. You know nothing, know nothing. You're just on bare army rations. Anyway, it came to an end, and we rejoined the unit, and we went then down to Suez, outside Suez, where we practiced mountaineering up these hills, Aqaba Hills, and it was used by the So his Alpine Club was their climbing ground. And we spent about, 3 weeks there. And then we finally came up to Alexandria and boarded ship ready for wherever we were going. And I know we were on the ship in Alexandria, 1943, on my birthday again, 4th of July. Anyway, that was a set. No, when was that? I forget what day it was. Anyway, the following day we set sail. And we went eastward up the Med. And all the time, there was more and more ships joining the convoy. Until on the Thursday night, as far as you could see, there were ships. And all day Friday, we did nothing else but circle. And we just thought, oh my God, if Jerry spots us here, what's going to happen? While we were aboard ship, they told us where we were going. They told us we were going to Sicily. And that some of the attacks would be feint attacks and some would be real. And it was no good anybody falling back to the beach thinking they'd be taken off. Because there wasn't. Nobody was going to be taken off. And I will say this. The intelligence was absolutely marvellous. They had samples of the beach where we were going to land, showing what areas the beach would take tanks, etc. They had low-level aerial photographs of the terrain where we were going to land. We were going to land at a little village south of Syracuse called Avola. And they not only had the lemon groves next to the beach in fine detail, but even the road beyond, and there was this road beyond the lemon field, lemon orchards, and about half a mile west was a little village of Evola, and they even had the schoolhouse picked out in these aerial photographs and blown up, showing you the actual buildings that we were going to occupy, the schoolhouse and the annexes, etc. And we, with our officers, we worked it out, what was going to be what was going to be reception, which would be the hospital ward and which would be the operating theatre. And all this we knew before we landed. They also told us what to do in all sorts of circumstances. Really frightening you to death, really. It was, if 10 or more of you got ashore, you then proceeded as you'd been told to this schoolhouse. If there was less than 10, you then reported to the beach master at Evola, and he would direct you what to do. Or what you had to do if your landing craft was hit and you were in blazing oil, how to try and survive in that by diving down, and then as you come up, lifting your arms above your head and splashing to clear, cause a clear space for you to get another breath and go down, and all this. Anyway, all day Friday we circled, and then as it came night, as it came dark, we then started moving again. And we moved close up to the beach. At 11 o'clock, everybody's duties aboard ship stopped, and you went to what they called your sally port. That was where you were going to disembark. And from 11 o'clock onwards, there was unlimited cocoa. Well, as I hate, it's cocoa, but it was on tap all night, was this cocoa. And they called you, it started about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they started calling different troops to the sally port and disembarking them. Well, we went ashore with the East and West Yorks, and we got ashore around about 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was just a piece of cake. There was nothing. There was no attack, no nothing. We just sailed up into the beach area, down went the ramp, and we did. I'll admit it was a wet landing, but it was unopposed. And we then went through this lemon grove and onto the road, and we got to this village of Evola and opened up. And that was a Saturday morning, 10th of July. We were there till Monday. We never stopped. There was no sleep, no nothing. Of course, we were all in our wet clothes, but they dried on you and such like. And Monday, we moved up to Syracuse. And we were on the, just on the far side of Syracuse. And we took over a German hospital, and the nuns, it had been a holy order at this place, and the nuns were still there. Anyway, this was day two, because D-Day, D1, D2, that's right. Day three, the rest of the unit was to arrive. I had been that busy that we couldn't make any preparation for them at all. Anyway, Rogers didn't like the Sergeant Major they'd got now, because Taffy Williams had been replaced, and this bloke had never seen any action at all. He'd been at base all the time. So I said to Major Rogers, what are we going to do about them? He says, they can help themselves. I says, let them sleep in that orchard there. And that's what we did. There was a lot of grumbling, but that was it. Anyway, about 10 days later, I developed rheumatism. And after 3 days, they decided they would have to evacuate me. So that's what they did, and they evacuated me to Tripoli. And I went on the hospital ship Landovery Castle. Anyway, this photograph here is when we had 5 days change of air leave in 42. And it shows me, Bob Reid and Corporal Staff when we visited the pyramids. This is Corporal Duggan. Sorry, Private Duggan. He came from Middlesbrough. This photograph was taken when he was on leave in Cairo. And he was a very brave man, was this Corporal Duggan. Anybody should have had a medal, he should have had one. He went into a minefield, knowing it was a minefield, to get a yank out of a jeep that had blown up. And although he was put up for an award, he got nothing. This is Sergeant Bob Reid, the cook. This photograph was taken when we were on leave in Cairo. This photograph of myself was taken in Cairo when we were on leave. This is my dress uniform, and I had it in store. I had a suitcase in store at Thomas Cook's, and I kept it there right until beginning of 1944. Anyway, this particular leave, I'd got the suitcase out to get some clean clothes out of it, and while I had it out, I got my dress uniform out and I had this photograph taken. When I was evacuated from Sicily, I'd taken down to the docks at Syracuse where we were put aboard a lighter, flat-bottom barge. And this was about 5 o'clock at night. And who should be in charge of the loading of these lighters but Jack Tate. Now, he'd been posted from our unit on promotion, and he was now a staff sergeant. And the reason he'd been posted was because there was no hope of promotion in our unit. And so they brought this thing in whereby if you had been held back because of no room for promotion, you could be posted on promotion to another unit. And Jack was in charge of the loading of the casualties. And although we had been such good friends all those years, I never saw him again, and I never heard from him again. Anyway, I went on this lighter to the Landovery Castle, and they loaded us aboard there. And they didn't get us fully loaded. And the normal practice, if they don't do that, was that the hospital ship would pull outside the 3 mile limit, fully illuminated, and just circle. But 2 days previously, I forget the name of the hospital ship, but another hospital ship was doing exactly that, and the Germans bombed it and sank it. So this time they decided to black out the ship, the hospital ship, and stay in the bay. Anyway, when the air raids started, the usual practice was to put a smoke screen across the harbour. And unfortunately, with this being the first time the ship had done this, they forgot to switch off the air ventilation, and all the smoke was pulled inside the ship. It was very unpleasant, but still. And we were there, they bombed, but of course they couldn't see what they were bombing or anything else. And this was the first time I'd ever had an old army standby called Mist 315s. Was used a lot in the medical corps, and it was morphine. Oh dear, what was it? Morphine, laudanum. Oh, and I forget the other ingredient. Anyway, they were all opaques. And They gave me a dose of that and pulled the life belt from under the wire bunk and stuck that on my chest. And the effects of this 315 was that it just laid there, and you hadn't a care in the world. You could hear the bombs going off and anything else, and instead of being apprehensive or anything else, you just laid there and took it. Anyway, next morning they finished loading and they took us to Tripoli. And it was to number 2 General Hospital. And what a flaming hospital that was. Gosh, Ruth. There was 120 patients in the one ward that I was in, so you can guess how much attention you got. Anyway, after 5 days there, the MO, he called the specialist, and he examined me, and it was next place on an evacuation, this man's to go to base. So that's what happened. I went down from Tripoli to Alexandria, and then from Alexandria by hospital train right down to Katara on the Suez Canal, number 1 General Hospital. And I was there for 2 months. I was then sent up to, on discharge, I was downgraded to base only and was sent to RAMC base depot at Cairo for reposting. I forgot to mention that on the Landovery Castle was Sergeant Billy Bloomfield. He was another one of our sergeants from the 15th Mobile CCS who had been posted. And he finished up on the Landovery Castle. And it was him who supplied me with this photograph of the ship. And I never met him or heard from him again. I found 4 photographs that I'd missed, so I'll include them now before I go any further. These first 3 were taken in the second push, and I think they're self-explanatory. This is the Nafi on the bypass at Sidi Barani. You could always stop there if you were anywhere in the area and get a cup of tea. It was very handy for the RASC blokes who were up and down the road delivering all the accoutrements of war. This is a signboard for Hellfire Pass. It was to direct traffic so that they'd get the easy way up the escarpment. The staff car, by the way, in the foreground is our OC's of staff car. And if we're travelling up the road and we had to pull off the road either to open up for any other reason, the CO used to park his staff car like that with the bonnet open at the side of the road, and we then knew that that was where we had to turn in off the road. This is the approach to Saloum Escarpment. This was a real bottleneck because you had to get up this escarpment here, and it was just as tight series of hairpins, and in the third push, Montgomery's push, there was so much traffic trying to get up that you had to pull off the road. There's about a 7-mile stretch of flatland either side of the road that had been cleared a mile of mines. You had to pull in there, and then CO had to report to military police at the bottom of the escarpment. tell him how many wagons he had, what they consisted of, and they worked out the time that you had to be at the foot of the escarpment, and you stayed on this flatland, and you allowed yourself about half an hour to get to the bottom of the escarpment, and if you weren't there on time, you lost your place, and you had to go back to this, well, call it a car park if you like, but it was just waste desert. And our time, the particular time that we had to go up at 5 o'clock one morning. And Rivalli was used to, Audley Sergeant Major used to drive around the encampment on a 1500 white pickup, banging an empty petrol tin. And that was the Rivalli. And this particular morning, we set off about 4:15. And the old man in his staff car was leading. And when we got about half a mile or less than half a mile up the road, we suddenly found out that there was only 6 trucks with us. Well, the old man went back and he created hell. Anyway, we got them all out. We managed to just beat the deadline and get up the escarpment, but bah, the old man was livid over that. Anyway, that's the last of the photographs of the pushes up the bloom. I was discharged from number 1 General Hospital, downgraded to B1 base, on the 20th of September, 43, and was sent to RAMC base depot at Cairo. Had quite a bit of trouble there because I was the first bloke that had who'd come from Sicily. And when you were evacuated from Sicily, you weren't allowed to bring anything away with you apart from your own personal toilet things. Everything else was left on the island, so of course I only had the clothes I stood up in. And it took them about 3 days to get confirmation of this from GHQ, otherwise they were going to charge me for all new kit. Anyway, as I say, it took about 3 days, and on the fourth day, I was posted to 13th General Hospital. Now, when I arrived at the base depot, the OC, in the interview that you have with him, it said, had I any preference for where I would like posting to? And as I was B1 base, I didn't want to be stuck at base, so I said, yeah, hospital ship. And instead of that, I got posted to 13th General, and not to the General Hospital, but to the African Native section, about the worst flaming posting you could have. This is the group of the European sergeants. Left to right is Jock Campbell, Bliss, Claude, now then, I've forgotten his name, Claude, I'll find it, and front row's myself, and then the next two, I can't remember their names for love nor money. Oh, Claude Faulkner. He was a very, very bitter man, was Claude, because in the Depression, in the 30-31, he joined the army on a special thing that they had. 3 years in the army and 7 years on reserve. Well, he did his 3 years and he came out of the army and he was on reserve. And when he came out of the army, he got a job in Rolls-Royce aero engine factory, which was a reserved occupation. But because he was on this reserve, that didn't count, and they coloured him back into the army. He was very bitter about that, was Claude. This is some more of the staff of the African Native section at 13th General. It was never known as the African Native Section in the hospital. It was always called the jungle.